It's time for the world to stop kidding itself, to wake up, to realize that the only problem of humanity is lack of love. Love breeds tolerance. Tolerance breeds peace. Intolerance produces war and looks indifferently upon intolerable conditions. Love cannot be indifferent. It does not know how. The fastest way to get to a place of love and concern for all humankind is to see all humankind as your family. The fastest way to see all humankind as your family is to stop separating yourself. Each of the nation states now making up your world must unite.
We do have the United Nations,
which has been powerless and impotent. In order for that body to work, it would have to be completely restructured. Not impossible, but perhaps difficult and cumbersome.
Okay, what do you propose?
I don't have a proposal. I merely offer observations. In this dialogue, you tell me what your new choices are, and I offer observations and ways to manifest that. What is it you now choose with regard to the current relationship between people and nations on your planet?
All right, I'll use your words. If I had my way, I would choose for us to get to a place of love and concern for all humankind.
Given that choice, I observe that what would work would be the formation of a new world political community, with each nation state having an equal say in the world's affairs and an equal proportionate share of the world's resources.
Ah, it'll never work. The haves will never surrender their sovereignty, wealth, resources to the have-nots. And argumentatively, why should they?
Because it is in their best interest.
Well, they don't see that, and I'm not sure that I do.
If you could add billions of dollars a year to your nation's economy, dollars which could be spent to feed the hungry, clothe the needy, house the poor, bring security to the elderly, provide better health, and produce a dignified standard of living for all, wouldn't that be in your nation's best interests?
Well, in America, there are those who would argue that it would help the poor at the expense of the rich and the middle-income taxpayer. Meanwhile, the country goes to hell, crime ravages the nation, inflation robs the people of their life savings, unemployment skyrockets, the government grows bigger and fatter, and in school they're handing out condoms.
You sound like a radio talk show.
Well, these are the concerns of many Americans.
Then they are short-sighted. Do you not see that if billions of dollars a year, that's millions a month, hundreds and hundreds of thousands a week, unheard of amounts each day, could be sunk back into your system, that if you could use these monies to feed your hungry, clothe your needy, house your poor, bring security to your elderly, and provide health care and dignity to all, the causes of crime would be lost forever? Do you not see that new jobs would mushroom as dollars were pumped back into your economy? That your own government could even be reduced because it would have less to do?
I suppose some of that could happen. I can't imagine government ever getting smaller, but just where are these millions and billions going to come from? Taxes imposed by your new world government? More taking from those who work to get it, to give to those who won't stand on their own two feet and go after it?
Is that how you frame it?
No, but it is how a great many people see it. I just wanted to fairly state their view.
Well, I'd like to talk about that later. Right now, I don't want to get off track, but I want to come back to that later.
Right.
But you've asked where these new dollars would come from. Well, they would not have to come from any new taxes imposed by the New World community, although members of the community, individual citizens, would want, under an enlightened governance, to send 10% of their income to provide for society's needs as a whole. Nor would they come from new taxes imposed by any local government. In fact, some local governments would surely be able to reduce taxes. All of this, all of these benefits, would result from the simple restructuring of your worldview. The simple reordering of your world political configuration.
How?
The money you save from building defense systems and attack weapons.
Oh, I get it. You want us to close down the military.
Not just you. Everybody in the world.
Oh.
But not close down your military. Simply reduce it drastically. Internal order would be your only need. You could strengthen local police. something you say you want to do, but cry each year at budget time that you cannot do. At the same time, dramatically reducing your spending on weapons of war and preparations for war. That is, offensive and defensive weapons of mass destruction.
Well, first, I think your figures exaggerate how much could be saved by doing that. Second, I don't think you'll ever convince people they should give up their ability to defend themselves.
Let's look at the numbers. As of March 1994, the world's governments spend about $1 trillion a year for military purposes. That's $1 million a minute worldwide. The nations that are spending the most could redirect the most to the other priorities mentioned. So larger, richer nations would see it in their best interest to do so, if they thought it was possible. But larger, richer nations cannot imagine going defenseless, for they fear aggression and attack from the nations which envy them and want what they have. There are two ways to eliminate this threat. Share enough of the world's total wealth and resources with all of the world's people so that no one will want and need what someone else has, and everyone may live in dignity and remove themselves from fear. Create a system for the resolution of differences that eliminates the need for war, and even the possibility of it.
The people of the world would probably never do this.
They already have.
They have?
Yes. There is a great experiment now going on in your world in just this sort of political order. That experiment is called the United States of America.
Which you said was failing miserably.
It is. It has very far to go before it could be called a success. Still, it is the best experiment going. As Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst system, except all others.
Your nation was the first to take a loose confederation of individual states and successfully unite them into a cohesive group, each submitting to one central authority. At the time, none of the states wanted to do this, and each resisted mightily, fearing the loss of its individual greatness and claiming that such a union would not serve its best interests. It may be instructive to understand just what was going on with these individual states at that time. While they had joined together in a loose confederation, there was no real U.S. government, and hence no power to enforce the Articles of Confederation to which the states had agreed. The states were conducting their own foreign affairs, several reaching private agreements on trade and other matters with France, Spain, England, and other countries. States traded with each other as well, and although their Articles of Confederation forbade it, some states added tariffs to the goods shipped in from other states, just as they did for goods from across the ocean. Merchants had no choice but to pay at the harbor if they wanted to buy or sell their goods, there being no central authority. Although there was a written agreement to prohibit such taxing, the individual states also fought wars with each other. Each state considered its militia a standing army. Nine states had their own navies, and "Don't Tread on Me" could have been the official motto of every state in the Confederation. Over half of the states were even printing their own money, although the Confederation had agreed that doing so would also be illegal. In short, your original states, though joined together under the Articles of Confederation, were acting exactly as independent nations do today. Although they could see that the agreements of their confederation, such as the granting to Congress the sole authority to coin money, were not working, they staunchly resisted creating and submitting to a central authority that could enforce these agreements and put some teeth into them. Yet in time, a few progressive leaders began to prevail. They convinced the rank and file that there was more to be gained by creating such a new federation than they would ever lose. Merchants would save money and increase profits because individual states could no longer tax each other's goods. Governments would save money and have more to put into programs and services that truly helped people because resources would not have to be used to protect individual states from each other. The people would have greater security and safety and greater prosperity, too, by cooperating with rather than fighting with each other. Far from losing their greatness, each state could become greater still. And that, of course, is exactly what has happened. The same could be made to happen with the 160 nation states in the world today if they were to join together in a united federation. It could mean an end to war.
How so? There would still be disagreements.
So long as humans remain attached to outer things, that is true. There's a way to truly eliminate war and all experience of unrest and lack of peace. But that is a spiritual solution. We are here exploring a geopolitical one. Actually, the trick is to combine the two. Spiritual truth must be lived in practical life to change everyday experience. Until this change occurs, there would still be disagreements. You are right. Yet there need not be wars. There need not be killing. Are there wars between California and Oregon over water rights? Between Maryland and Virginia over fishing? Between Wisconsin and Illinois? Ohio and Massachusetts?
No.
Then why not? Have not various disputes and differences arisen between them?
Through the years, I suppose so.
You can bet on it. But these individual states have voluntarily agreed. It was a simple, voluntary agreement to abide by certain laws and abide by certain compromises on matters common to them, while retaining the right to pass separate statutes on matters relating to each individually. And when disputes between states do arise due to differing interpretations of the federal law, or someone simply breaking that law, the matter is taken to a court, which has been granted the authority, that is, given the authority by the states to resolve the dispute. And if the current body of law does not provide a precedent or a means by which the matter can be brought through the courts to a satisfactory resolution, the states and the people in them send their representatives to a central government to try to create agreement on new laws that will produce a satisfactory circumstance, or at the very least, a reasonable compromise. This is how your federation works. A system of laws, a system of courts, empowered by you to interpret those laws, and a justice system, backed by armed might, if needed, to enforce the decisions of those courts. Although no one could argue that the system doesn't need improving, this political concoction has worked for more than 200 years. There is no reason to doubt that the same recipe will work between nation states as well.
If this is so simple, why hasn't it been tried?
It has. Your League of Nations was an early attempt. The United Nations is the latest. Yet one failed and the other has been only minimally effective because, like the 13 states of America's original confederation, the member nation states, particularly the most powerful, are afraid they have more to lose than to gain from the reconfiguration. That is because the people of power are more concerned with holding on to their power than with improving the quality of life for all people. The haves know that such a world federation would inevitably produce more for the have-nots. But the haves believe this would come at their expense, and they're giving up nothing.
Isn't their fear justified? And is wanting to hold on to what you have so long struggled for unreasonable?
First, it is not necessarily true that to give more to those who now hunger and thirst and live without shelter, others must give up their abundance. As I pointed out, all you would have to do is take the $1 trillion spent annually worldwide for military purposes and shift that to humanitarian purposes, and you will have solved the problem without spending an additional penny or shifting any of the wealth from where it now resides to where it does not. Of course, it could be argued that those international conglomerates whose profits come from war and tools for war would be losers, as would their employees and all those whose abundance is derived from the world's conflict consciousness. But perhaps your source of abundance is misplaced. If one has to depend on the world living in strife in order for one to survive, perhaps this dependence explains why your world resists any attempt to create a structure for lasting peace. As for the second part of your question, wanting to hold on to to what you have struggled so long to acquire, as an individual or as a nation, is not unreasonable if you come from an outside world consciousness.
A what?
If you derive your life's greatest happiness from experiences obtainable only in the outside world, the physical world outside of yourself, you will never want to give up an ounce of all that you've piled up as a person and a nation to make you happy. As long as those who have not see their unhappiness tied to the lack of material things, they too will get caught in the trap. They will constantly want what you have got, and you will constantly refuse to share it. That's why I said earlier that there is a way to truly eliminate war and all experience of unrest and lack of peace, but this is a spiritual solution. Ultimately, every geopolitical problem, just as every personal problem, breaks down to a spiritual problem. All of life is spiritual, and therefore all of life's problems are spiritually based and spiritually solved. Wars are created on your planet because somebody has something that somebody else wants. This is what causes someone to do something that somebody else does not want them to do. All conflict arises from misplaced desire. The only peace in all the world that is sustaining is internal peace. Let each person find peace within. When you find peace within, you also find that you can do without. This means simply that you no longer need the things of your outside world. Not needing is a great freedom. It frees you first from fear. Fear that there is something you won't have. Fear that there is something you have that you will lose. And fear that without a certain thing, you won't be happy. Secondly, not needing frees you from anger. Anger is fear announced. When you have nothing to fear, you have nothing over which to be angry. You're not angry when you don't get what you want, because your wanting it was simply a preference, not a necessity. You therefore have no fear associated with the possibility of not getting it, hence no anger. You are not angry when you see others doing what you don't want them to do, because you don't need them to do or not do any particular thing, hence no anger. You're not angry when someone is unkind because you have no need for them to be kind. You have no anger when someone is unloving because you have no need for them to love you. You have no anger when someone is cruel or hurtful or seeks to damage you, for you have no need for them to behave any other way, and you are clear that you cannot be damaged. You do not even have anger should someone seek to take your life, because you do not fear death. When fear is taken from you, all else can be taken from you, and you will not be angry. You know inwardly, intuitively, that everything you've created can be created again, or more importantly, that it doesn't matter. When you find inner peace, neither the presence nor the absence of any person, place, or thing, condition, circumstances, or situation can be the creator of your state of mind or the cause of your experience of being. This doesn't mean that you reject all things of the body. Far from it. You experience being fully in your body and the delights of that as you never have before. Yet your involvement with things of the body will be voluntary, not mandatory. You will experience bodily sensations because you choose to, not because you're required to in order to feel happy or to justify sadness. This one simple change, seeking and finding peace within, could, were it undertaken by everyone, end all wars, eliminate conflict, prevent injustice, and bring the world to everlasting peace. There is no other formula necessary or possible. World peace is a personal thing. What is needed is not a change of circumstance, but a change of consciousness.
How can we find inner peace when we're hungry, be at a place of serenity when we thirst, remain calm when we're wet and cold and without shelter, or avoid anger when our loved ones are dying without cause? You know, you speak so poetically, but is poetry practical? Does it have anything to say to the mother in Ethiopia who watches her emaciated child die for lack of one slice of bread? The man in Central America who feels a bullet rip his body because he tried to stop an army from taking over his village? And what does your poetry say to the woman in Brooklyn, raped 8 times by a gang? Or the family of 6 in Ireland, blown away by a terrorist bomb planted in a church on a Sunday morning?
This is difficult to hear, but I tell you this. There is perfection in everything. Strive to see the perfection. This is the change of consciousness of which I speak. Need nothing. Desire everything. Choose what shows up. Feel your feelings. Cry your cries. Laugh your laughs. Honor your truth. Yet when all the emotion is done, be still and know that I am God. In other words, in the midst of the greatest tragedy, see the glory of the process. Even as you die with a bullet through your chest, even as you are being gang raped. Now, this sounds like such an impossible thing to do, yet when you move to God consciousness, you can do it. You don't have to do it, of course. It depends on how you wish to experience the moment. In a moment of great tragedy, the challenge always is to quiet the mind and move deeply within the soul. You automatically do this when you have no control over it. Have you ever talked with a person who accidentally ran a car off a bridge or found himself facing a gun or nearly drowned? Often they will tell you that time slowed way down, that they were overcome by a curious calm, that there was no fear at all. Fear not, for I am with you. That is what poetry has to say to the person facing tragedy. In your darkest hour, I will be your light. In your blackest moment, I will be your consolation. In your most difficult and trying time, I will be your strength. Therefore, have faith, for I am your shepherd. You shall not want. I will cause you to lie down in green pastures. I will lead you beside still waters. I will restore your soul and lead you in the paths of righteousness for my name's sake.
And yea, though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you will fear no evil, for I am with you. My rod and my staff will comfort you. I am preparing a table before you in the presence of your enemies. I shall anoint your head with oil. Your cup will run over. Surely goodness and mercy will follow you all the days of your life, and you will dwell in my house and in my heart forever.
That's wonderful. What you said there is just wonderful. I wish the world could get that. I wish the world could understand, could believe.
This program will help that. You are helping that. So you are playing a role, you are doing your part in raising the collective consciousness. That is what all must do.
Yes. Well, can we move to a new subject now? I think it's important that we talk about this attitude, this idea of things which you said a while back that you wanted to fairly present. The attitude to which I'm referring is this attitude held by many people, actually, that the poor have been given enough, that we must stop taxing the rich, penalizing them in effect for working hard and making it, to provide even more for the poor. These people believe that the poor are poor, basically because they want to be. Many don't even attempt to pull themselves up. They would rather suckle at the government teat than assume responsibility for themselves. There are many people who believe that redistribution of the wealth, sharing, is a socialistic evil. They cite the Communist Manifesto, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, as evidence of the satanic origin of the idea of ensuring the basic human dignity of all through the efforts of everyone. These people believe in every man for himself. And if they are told that this concept is cold or heartless, they take refuge in the statement that opportunity knocks at the door of everyone equally. They claim that no one man operates under an inherent disadvantage. But if they could make it, everyone can. And if someone doesn't, it's his own damn fault.
You feel that is an arrogant thought rooted in ungratefulness?
Yes. But what do you feel?
I have no judgment in the matter. It is simply a thought. There's only one question of any relevance regarding this or any other thought. Does it serve you to hold that? In terms of who you are and who you seek to be, does that thought serve you? Looking at the world, that is the question people have to ask. Does it serve us to hold this thought? I observe this. There are people, indeed entire groups of people, who have been born into what you call disadvantage. This is observably true. It is also true that at a very high metaphysical level, no one is disadvantaged, for each soul creates for itself the exact people, events, and circumstances needed to accomplish what it wishes to accomplish. You choose everything. Your parents, your country of birth, all the circumstances surrounding your reentry. Similarly, throughout the days and times of your life, you continue to choose and to create people, events, and circumstances designed to bring you the exact, right, and perfect opportunities you now desire in order to know yourself as you truly are. In other words, no one is disadvantaged given what the soul wishes to accomplish. For example, the soul may wish to work with a handicapped body, or in a repressive society, or under enormous political or economic constraints, in order to produce the conditions needed to accomplish what it has set out to do. So we see that people do face disadvantages in the physical sense, but that these are actually the right and perfect conditions metaphysically.
As a practical matter, what does that mean to us? Should we offer help to the disadvantaged, or simply see that, in truth, they are just where they want to be and thus allow them to work out their own karma?
That's a very good and a very important question. Remember first that everything you think, say, and do is a reflection of what you've decided about yourself, a statement of who you are, an act of creation in your deciding who you want to be. I keep returning to that, because that is the only thing you are doing here. That is what you are up to. There's nothing else going on, no other agenda for the soul. You are seeking to be and to experience who you really are. And to create that, you are creating yourself anew in every moment of now. Now, within that context, when you come across a person who appears in relative terms, as observed within your world, to be disadvantaged, the first question you have to ask is, who am I and who do I choose to be in relationship to that? In other words, the first question when you encounter another in any circumstance should always be, what do I want here? Did you hear that? Your first question always must be, what do I want here? Not, what does the other person want here?
That's the most fascinating insight I've ever received about the way to proceed in human relationships. It also runs against everything I've ever been taught.
I know. But the reason your relationships are in such a mess is that you're always trying to figure out what the other person wants and what other people want instead of what you truly want. Then you have to decide whether to give it to them. And here's how you decide. You decide by taking a look at what you may want from them. If there's nothing you think you'll want from them, your first reason for giving them what they want disappears. And so you very seldom do it. If, on the other hand, you see that there is something you want or may want from them, then your self-survival mode kicks in and you try to give them what they want. Then you resent it, especially if the other person doesn't eventually give you what you want. In this game of I'll trade you, you set up a very delicate balance. You meet my needs and I'll meet yours. That the purpose of all human relationships, relationships between nations as well as relationships between individuals, has nothing to do with any of this. The purpose of your holy relationship with every other person, place, or thing is not to figure out what they want or need, but what you require or desire now in order to grow, in order to be who you want to be. That is why I created relationship to other things. If it weren't for this, you could have continued to live in a vacuum, a void, the eternal allness whence you came. Yet in the allness you simply are and cannot experience your awareness as anything in particular, because in the allness there is nothing you are not. So I devised a way for you to create anew and know who you are in your experience. I did this by providing you with relativity, a system wherein you could exist as a thing in relationship to something else. Forgetfulness, a process by which you willingly submit to total amnesia so that you can not know that relativity is merely a trick and that you are all of it. Consciousness, a state of being in which you grow until you reach full awareness, then becoming a true and living God, creating and experiencing your own reality, expanding and exploring that reality, changing and recreating that reality as you stretch your consciousness to new limits, or shall we say to no limit. In this paradigm, consciousness is everything. Consciousness, that of which you are truly aware, is the basis of all truth, and thus of all true spirituality.
But what is the point of it all? First you make us forget who we are, so that we can remember who we are?
Not quite. So that you can create who you are and who you want to be. This is the act of God being God. It is me being me, through you. This is the point of all life. Through you, I experience being who and what I am. Without you, I could know it, but not experience it. Knowing and experiencing are two different things. I'll choose experiencing every time. Indeed, I do. Through you.
I seem to have lost the original question here.
Well, it's hard to keep God on one subject. I am kind of expansive. Let's see if we can get back. Oh, yes. What to do about the less fortunate.
Uh-huh.
First, decide who and what you are in relationship to them. Second, if you decide you wish to experience yourself as being succor, as being help, as being love and compassion and caring, then look to see how you can best be those things. And notice that your ability to be those things has nothing to do with what others are being or doing. Sometimes the best way to love someone and the most help you can give is to leave them alone or empower them to help themselves.
Mm.
It's like a feast. Life is a smorgasbord, and you can give them a big helping of themselves. Remember that the greatest help you can give a person is to wake them up, to remind them of who they really are. There are many ways to do this, sometimes with a little bit of help, a push, a shove, a nudge, and sometimes with a decision to let them run their course, follow their path, walk their walk, without any interference or intervention from you. All parents know about this choice and agonize over it daily. What you have the opportunity to do for the less fortunate is to remind them. That is, cause them to be of a new mind about themselves. And you too have to be of a new mind about them. For if you see them as unfortunate, they will. Jesus' great gift was that he saw everyone as who they truly are. He refused to accept appearances. He refused to believe what others believed of themselves. He always had a higher thought, and he always invited others to it. Yet he also honored where others chose to be. He did not require them to accept his higher idea, merely held it out as an invitation. He dealt, too, with compassion, and if others chose to see themselves as beings needing assistance, he didn't reject them for their faulty assessment, but allowed them to love their reality, and lovingly assisted them in playing out their choice. For Jesus knew that for some, the fastest path to who they are was the path through who they are not. He didn't call this an imperfect path and thus condemn it. Rather, he saw this too as perfect, and thus supported everyone in being just who they wanted to be. Anyone, therefore, who asked Jesus for help received it. He denied no one, but was always careful to see that the help he gave supported a person's full and honest desire. If others genuinely sought enlightenment, honestly expressing readiness to move to the next level, Jesus gave them the strength, the courage, the wisdom to do so. He held himself out, and rightly so, as an example and encouraged people, if they could do nothing else, to have faith in him. He would not, he said, lead them astray. Many did put their faith in him, and to this day he helps those who call upon his name. For his soul is committed to waking up those who seek to be fully awake and fully alive in me. Yet Christ had mercy on those who did not. He therefore rejected self-righteousness and, as do I, made no judgments ever. Jesus' idea of perfect love was to grant all persons exactly the help they requested, after telling them the kind of help they could get. He never refused to help anyone, and least of all would he do so out of a thought that you made your bed, now lie in it. Jesus knew that if he gave people the help they asked for, rather than merely the help he wanted to give, that he was empowering them at the level at which they were ready to receive empowerment. This is the way of all great masters, those who have walked your planet in the past and those who are walking it now.
Now I am confused. When is it disempowering to offer help? When does it work against, rather than for, another's growth?
When your help is offered in such a way that it creates continued dependence rather than rapid independence. When you allow another, in the name of compassion, to begin to rely on you rather than rely on themselves, that is not compassion, that is compulsion. You have a power compulsion, because that sort of helping is really power tripping. Now, this distinction can be very subtle here, and sometimes you don't even know you are power tripping. You really believe you are simply doing your best to help another. Yet be careful that you're not simply seeking to create your own self-worth. For to the extent that you allow other persons to make you responsible for them, to that extent you have allowed them to make you powerful. And that, of course, makes you feel worthy. Yet this kind of help is an aphrodisiac which seduces the weak. The goal is to help the weak grow strong, not to let the weak become weaker. This is the problem with many government assistance programs, for they often do the latter rather than the former. Government programs can be self-perpetuating. Their objective can be every bit as much to justify their existence as to help those they are meant to assist. If there were a limit to all government assistance, people would be helped when they genuinely need help, but could not become addicted to that help, substituting it for their own self-reliance. Governments understand that help is power. That is why governments offer as much help to as many people as they can get away with. For the more people government helps, the more people help the government. Whom the government supports, supports the government.
Then there should be no redistribution of wealth. The Communist Manifesto is satanic.
Of course, there is no Satan, but I understand your meaning. The idea behind the statement, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, is not evil. It is beautiful. It is simply another way of saying you are your brother's keeper. It's the implementation of this beautiful idea that can become ugly. Sharing must be a way of life, not an edict imposed by government. Sharing should be voluntary, not forced.
But here we go again. At its best, government is the people, and its programs are simply mechanisms by which the people share with many others as a way of life. And I would argue that people, collectively through their political systems, have chosen to do so because people have observed, and history has shown, that the haves do not share with the have-nots. The Russian peasant could have waited until hell froze over for the Russian nobility to share its wealth, which was usually gained and enlarged, by the way, through the hard work of the peasants. The peasants were given just enough to subsist on as the incentive to keep working the land and make the land barons richer. Talk about a dependency relationship. This was an I'll help you only if you help me arrangement, more exploitive and more obscene than anything ever invented by government. It was this obscenity against which the Russian peasants revolted. A government which ensured that all people were treated equally was born out of the people's frustration that the haves would not give to the have-nots of their own accord. It was as Marie Antoinette said of the starving masses clamoring beneath her window in rags while she lounged in a gold inlaid tub on a bejeweled pedestal munching imported grapes. Let them eat cake. This is the attitude against which the downtrodden have railed. This is the condition causing revolution and creating governments of so-called oppression. Governments which take from the rich and give to the poor are called oppressive, while governments which do nothing while the rich exploit the poor are called repressive. Ask the peasants of Mexico, even today. It's said that 20 or 30 families, the rich and powerful elite, literally run Mexico, principally because they own it, while 20 or 30 million live in utter deprivation. So the peasants in 1993 and 94 undertook a revolt seeking to force the elitist government to recognize its duty to help the people provide the means for a life of at least meager dignity. There's a difference between elitist governments and governments of, by, and for the people. Are not people's governments created by angry people frustrated over the basic selfishness of human nature? Are not government programs created as a remedy for man's unwillingness to provide a remedy himself? Is this not the genesis of fair housing laws, child labor statutes, support programs for mothers with dependent children? Wasn't Social Security government's attempt to provide for older people something that their own families would not or could not provide? How do we reconcile our hatred of government control with our lack of willingness to do anything we don't have to do when there are no controls? You know, it's said that some coal miners worked under horrible conditions before governments required the filthy rich mine owners to clean up their filthy mines. Why didn't the owners do so themselves? Because it would have cut into their profits. And the rich didn't care how many of the poor died in unsafe mines to keep the profits flowing and growing. Businesses paid slave wages to beginning workers before governments imposed minimum wage requirements. Those who favor going back to the good old days say, so what? They provided jobs, didn't they? And who's taking the risk anyway? The worker? No, the investor, the owner takes the risks. So let him get the biggest reward. Anyone who thinks that the workers, on whose labors the owners depend, should be treated with dignity, is called a communist. Anyone who thinks that a person should not be denied housing because of skin color is called a socialist. Anyone who thinks that a woman should not be denied employment opportunities or promotion simply because she's the wrong sex is called a radical feminist. And when governments, through their elected representatives, move to solve these problems that people of power in society steadfastly refuse to solve themselves, those governments are called oppressive. Never by the people they help, incidentally, only by the people who refuse to provide the help themselves. Nowhere is this more evident than in healthcare. In 1992, an American president and his wife decided it was unfair and inappropriate for millions of Americans to have no access to preventative healthcare. That simple notion started a healthcare debate which catapulted even the medical profession and the insurance industry into the fray. The real question is not whose solution was better, the plan proposed by the administration or the plan proposed by private industry. The real question is, why didn't private industry propose its own solution long ago? I'll tell you why. Because it didn't have to. No one was complaining, and the industry was driven by profits. Profits, profits, profits. My point, therefore, is this. We can rail and cry and complain all we want. The plain truth is governments provide solutions when the private sector won't. We can also claim that governments are doing what they're doing against the wishes of the people, but so long as people control the government, as they still do to a large extent in the United States, the government will continue to produce and require solutions to social ills because the majority of the people are not rich and powerful, and therefore legislate for themselves what society will not give them voluntarily. Only in countries where the majority of people do not control the government does government do little or nothing about inequities. So then, the problem. How much government is too much government? And how much is too little? And where and how do we strike the balance?
Whew! I've never seen you go on like this. That's as long as you've ever held the floor.
Well, you said we were going to address some of the larger global problems facing the family of man. I think I've laid out a big one.
Eloquently, yes. Everyone from Toynbee to Jefferson to Marx has been trying to solve it for hundreds of years.
Okay, what's your solution?
We are going to have to go backwards here. We're going to have to go over some old ground.
Go ahead. Maybe I need to hear it twice.
Then we'll start with the fact that I have no solution. And that is because I see none of this as problematical. It just is what it is. And I have no preferences regarding that. I'm merely describing here what is observable, what anyone can plainly see.
Okay, you have no solution and you have no preference. Can you offer me an observation?
I observe that the world has yet to come up with a system of government which provides a total solution, although the government in the United States has come the closest so far. The difficulty is that goodness and fairness are moral issues, not political ones. Government is the human attempt to mandate goodness and ensure fairness. Yet there's only one place where goodness is born, and that is in the human heart. There's only one place where fairness can be conceptualized, and that is in the human mind. There's only one place where love can be experienced truly, and that is in the human soul. Because the human soul is love. You cannot legislate morality. You cannot pass a law saying love each other. You're now going around in circles, as we have covered all of this before. Still, the discussion is good, so keep plugging away. Even if we cover the same ground twice or three times, that is okay. The attempt here is to get to the bottom of it. See how you want to create it now.
Well, then, I'll ask the same question I asked before. Aren't all laws simply man's attempt to codify moral concepts? Is not legislation simply our combined agreement as to what is right and wrong?
Yes. And certain civil laws, rules, and regulations are required in your primitive society. You understand that in non-primitive societies, such laws are unnecessary. All beings regulate themselves. In your society, you are still confronted with some very elementary questions. Shall you stop at the street corner before proceeding? Shall you buy and sell according to certain terms? Will there be any restrictions on how you behave with one another? But truly, even these basic laws, prohibitions against murdering, damaging, cheating, or even running a red light, shouldn't be needed and wouldn't be needed if all people everywhere simply followed the laws of love. That is God's law. What is needed is a growth in consciousness, not a growth of government.
You mean if we just followed the Ten Commandments, we'd be all right?
There's no such thing as the Ten Commandments. God's law is no law. This is something you cannot understand. I require nothing.
Is that what you're suggesting for this world? Complete anarchy?
I am suggesting nothing. I am merely observing what works. I am telling you what is observably so. And no, I do not observe that anarchy, the absence of governance, rules, regulations, or limitations of any kind, would work. Such an arrangement is only practical with advanced beings, which I do not observe human beings to be. So some level of governance is going to be required until your race evolves to the point where you naturally do what is naturally right. You're very wise to govern yourselves in the interim. The points you made a moment ago are salient, unassailable. people often do not do what is right when left to their own devices. The real question is not why do governments impose so many rules and regulations on the people, but why do governments have to? The answer has to do with your separation consciousness.
The fact that we see ourselves as separate from one another.
Yes.
But if we aren't separate, then we are one. And doesn't that mean we are responsible for each other?
Yes.
But doesn't that disempower us from achieving individual greatness? I mean, if I'm responsible for all others, then the Communist Manifesto was right. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need.
That is, as I've already said, a very noble idea. But it is robbed of its nobility when it is ruthlessly enforced. That was the difficulty with communism. Not the concept, but its implementation.
But there are those who say that the concept had to be enforced because the concept violates the basic nature of man.
You've hit the nail on the head. What needs to be changed is the basic nature of man. That's where the work must be done.
To create the consciousness shift of which you've spoken.
Yes.
But we're going around in circles again. Would not a group consciousness cause individuals to be disempowered?
Let's look at it. If every person on the planet had basic needs met, if the mass of the people could live in dignity and escape the struggle of simple survival, would this not open the way for all of humankind to engage in more noble pursuits? Would individual greatness really be suppressed if individual survival were guaranteed? Must universal dignity be sacrificed to individual glory? What kind of glory is obtained when it is achieved at the expense of another? I have placed more than sufficient resources on your planet to ensure adequate supplies for all. How can it be that thousands starve to death each year? That hundreds go homeless? That millions cry out for simple dignity? The kind of help that would end this is not the kind of help which disempowers. If you're well off, say they do not want to help the starving and the homeless because they do not want to disempower them. Then you're well off, are hypocrites. For no one is truly well off if they are well off while others are dying. The evolution of a society is measured by how well it treats the least among its members. As I've said, the challenge is to find the balance between helping people and hurting.
Okay, are there any guidelines you can offer?
An overall guideline might be this. When in doubt, always err on the side of compassion. The test of whether you are helping or hurting, are your fellow humans enlarged or reduced as a result of your help? Have you made them bigger or smaller, more able or less able?
It has been said that if you give everything to individuals, they'll be less willing to work for it themselves.
Yet why should they have to work for the simplest dignity? Is there not enough for all? Why should working for it have to do with anything? Isn't basic human dignity the birthright of everyone? Oughtn't it be? If one seeks more than minimum levels, more food, bigger shelters, finer coverings for the body, one can seek to achieve these goals. But ought one have to struggle to even survive on a planet where there is more than enough for everyone? That's the central question facing humankind. The challenge is not to make everyone equal, but to give everyone at least the assurance of basic survival with dignity, so that each may then have the chance to choose what more they want from there.
There are those who would argue that some don't even take that chance. I mean, even when it's given to them.
And they observe correctly. This raises yet another question. To those who don't take the opportunities presented to them, do you owe another chance and another?
No.
If I took that attitude, you would be lost to hell forever. I tell you this, compassion never ends. Love never stops. Patience never runs out in God's world. Only in the world of man is goodness limited. In my world, goodness is endless.
Even if we don't deserve it.
You always deserve it.
Even if we throw your goodness back in your face?
Especially if you do. If a man slaps you on the right cheek, turn and offer him your left. And if a man asks you to go 1 mile with him, go with him twain. When you throw my goodness back in my face, which, by the way, the human race has done to God for millennia, I see that you are merely mistaken. You do not know what is in your best interest. I have compassion because your mistake is based not in evil, but in ignorance.
But some people are basically evil. Some people are intrinsically bad.
Who told you that?
It is my own observation.
Then you cannot see straight. I've said it to you before. No one does anything evil given his model of the world. Put another way, all are doing the best they can at any given moment. All actions of everyone depend on the data at hand. I've said this before. Consciousness is everything. Of what are you aware? What do you know?
But when people attack us, hurt us, damage us, even kill us for their own ends, isn't that evil?
I've told you before, all attack is a call for help. No one truly desires to hurt another. Those who do it, including your own governments, by the way, do it out of a misplaced idea that it is the only way to get something they want. I've already outlined the higher solution to this problem. Simply want nothing. Have preferences, but no needs. Yet this is a very high state of being. It's the place of masters. In terms of geopolitics, why not work together as a world to meet the most basic needs of everyone?
We're doing that. Or trying.
After all these thousands of years of human history, that's the most you can say. The fact is, you've barely evolved at all. You still operate in a primitive every-man-for-himself mentality. You plunder the earth, rape her of her resources, exploit her people, and systematically disenfranchise those who disagree with you for doing all of this, calling them the radicals. You do all this for your own selfish purposes because you've developed a lifestyle that you cannot maintain any other way. You must cut down millions of acres of trees each year or you won't be able to have your Sunday paper. You must destroy miles of the protective ozone which covers your planet or you cannot have your hairspray. You must pollute your rivers and streams beyond repair or you cannot have your industries to give you bigger, better, and more. And you must exploit the least among you, the least advantaged, the least educated, the least aware, or you cannot live at the top of the human scale in unheard of and unnecessary luxury. Finally, you must deny that you are doing this, or you cannot live with yourself. You cannot find it in your heart to live simply so that others may simply live. That bumper sticker wisdom is too simple for you. It is too much to ask, too much to give. After all, you've worked so hard for what you've got. You ain't given up none of it. And if the rest of the human race, to say nothing of your own children's children, have to suffer for it, tough bananas, right? You did what you had to do to survive, to make it. They can do the same. After all, it is every man for himself, is it not?
Oh, and is there any way out of this mess?
Yeah. Shall I say it again? A shift of consciousness. You can't solve the problems which plague humankind through governmental action or by political means. You've been trying that for thousands of years. The change that must be made can be made only in the hearts of people.
Can you put that change into just one sentence?
I already have several times. You must stop seeing God as separate from you and you as separate from each other. The only solution is the ultimate truth. Nothing exists in the universe that is separate from anything else. Everything is intrinsically connected, irrevocably interdependent, interactive, interwoven into the fabric of all of life. All government, all politics must be based on this truth. All laws must be rooted in it. This is the future hope of your race. The only hope for your planet.
How does the law of love you spoke of earlier work?
Love gives all and requires nothing.
How can we require nothing?
If everyone in your race gave all, what would you require? The only reason you require anything is because someone else is holding back. Stop holding back.
Well, this couldn't work unless we all did it at once.
Indeed, a global consciousness is what is required. Yet how will that come about?
Somebody has to start. The opportunity is here for you.
You can be the source of this new consciousness.
You can be the inspiration.
Indeed, you must be.
I must?
Who else is there?
Welcome to the continuation of our panel dialogue. This is Michael Toms of New Dimensions Radio, and our guests are Marianne Williamson, author of Return to Love, Raymond Moody, author of Life After Life and Reunions, and Neil Donald Walsh, author of Conversations with God. One of the statements that comes up in both books 1 and 2 is the statement, and I realize this is out of context, but it's a very strong statement, there is no evil. I'd like you to respond to that statement, there is no evil.
I can tell you my first comment is that Marianne and Raymond better agree with me or it will be very evil.
No, well, I can't agree with you, actually, but I think that it's a semantic difference. I think I know your philosophy well enough to know what is intended by that. I believe that there is clearly evil in the world. I think that there's that the torture and murder of innocent children is evil. But I also believe that I understand the context in which that statement is made.
Yes, Michael took the statement totally out of context.
Right, exactly.
And
there
that's
is
what makes
no
it stand alone with such a stark
right. And I
contrast.
Think that we have to be real careful about that one because I think that that is an area where this whole area of thinking that we are involved in can be deeply misunderstood and easily invalidated if we're not clear about the context in which we speak. The way I read Neil's books is the way I understand it from other metaphysical literature, which is that darkness, there is no entity called darkness. Darkness is merely the absence of light. And so it is that evil isn't an entity of itself, but merely the energy which is manifest in the absence of love or light.
As a matter of fact, Book 1 in the CWG trilogy clearly says that the biggest evil would be to declare that there is no evil.
Yeah, just think of all the darkness and the evil result that can result. I think that one of the things that's very important for this kind of work and where I think Raymond and Neil and myself and all of us who are involved in these kinds of works have to be very careful is that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. once said that what we need are people who have tough minds and tender hearts. And it is true that some of the toughest minds in America today lack heart. But I think it is also true that some of the most open-hearted people are fuzzy thinkers. And I think that we have to be alert to that. There are many people who would love to think that evil is not real as an excuse for not participating fully and engaging fully in the world.
And cleaning up the evil. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the danger...
That's a very insightful comment.
I think one danger in talking about this question of whether there is evil and so on is that at a certain point you run the risk of legitimizing the demonizing process, and that's definitely a baneful influence on human affairs. I think it's so easy for people to project their own likes and dislikes out onto their enemies and call their enemies the embodiment of evil. We've seen that in the medieval witchcraft frenzy and even in the modern society that recurs again and again too. So I think that God did right in these books to caution people about too ready a tendency to characterize someone else as evil.
Shakespeare said, "Nothing is evil, lest thinking make it so." That really is the whole point of both books, if we were to bring it down to very human terms. Our thoughts about what is evil and our decisions about that is what creates it and what defines it as evil. And I agree with you, Raymond, we need to be very careful, obviously far more careful than we've been as a human race in the past, in constructing those definitions.
I think that the issue here has to do with the personal demonization. For instance, I agree with Raymond. If you point at a person and say they're the devil, which is obviously common. You point at a person, say they're the problem. The real problem, the real devil, is the pointed finger. The real devil is our thinking, which would have us see guilt in another person. I understand that, and I totally agree with that. And I still would hold that we have to be real careful here because there is another problem, which to me ultimately is just as dangerous, and that is when you have millions of people thinking it's okay and somehow using metaphysical principle to help justify the fact that they're simply not moved to action when 12-year-old boys are having their throats slit as a form of genocide in one country or another.
Every act in life is an act of self-definition. Experiences that we encounter give us an opportunity to be and to declare, to decide and to announce, to become and to fulfill who we really are.
if we are people who can look in the face of the kinds of experiences, the kinds of horrible, horrible human encounters that you're talking about, Marianne, if who we are in the face of that is someone who would ignore it, walk away from it, or try to rationalize it with some New Age piece of fluff like there is no evil, then that's, in fact, who we are. I'm sorry to say I'd be disappointed if I'd made that statement about myself, and I am to some degree disappointed when I see other people making that kind of statement through their apathy and through their inaction. So I hear really what you're both saying, and as is always true in terribly complex matters like this, both of you, and for that matter my own comments, are all right. We're all correct on this.
Because truth is not a soundbite. People have to hang long enough for the total conversation.
Marianne, picking up on something you said, there are a lot of open hearts, but many of them are fuzzy thinkers. Could you describe what you mean by fuzzy thinking?
I've got some very definite opinions on that one.
Go for it.
As a logician and a professor of logic for many years, I heartily endorsed what God had to say in Book 2 about the difficulty in our education being these days that we try to teach our kids what to think, rather than how to think. And Thomas Jefferson said, in a republican nation whose citizens are to be led by reason and persuasion and not by force, the art of reasoning becomes of first importance. And that's something I worry a little bit about. First of all, I want to say that I am a media freak. I love television. I watch 2 or 3 hours of CNN every day. So I'm not putting the media down here. But I do feel a certain danger in what I see and the way that public discourse has shrunk, in effect, to the soundbite model of public discourse. There are many things, in fact, truths that just can't be formulated in a short sentence that's going to be gripping on the morning television shows. And I think that's something that we really need to be careful about because, to go back again to that statement of Thomas Jefferson, the founding fathers saw very clearly that being a fairly good thinker and reasoner is a necessary part of being a functional citizen of a democracy.
I think that what Raymond's talking about now is in my mind, almost the primary issue of our time, because I think the greatest darkness in America today is the deadening of the American mind. And I do believe that it starts with the public education system that has come to be more concerned with teaching people what to think rather than how to think. I personally believe that television, you know, Raymond, when you say you watch 3 hours of CNN, CNN is not typical of most television. And although I share with you a passion for C-SPAN, that's real different from most television fare, which I think has contributed to the, you know, Neil Postman in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, talks about
yes.
how the linear thought processes of a generation have been destroyed by what most television is. And I also think it's interesting to note that people like us, if I could use that phrase, this whole idea of whatever we are, that they like to label New Age as a way of marginalizing and peripheralizing us, as far as I can see. Whatever this new consciousness work is that we are all involved in, it's interesting to me that there is so much projection onto it by those who would seek to invalidate it, that somehow it is less sophisticated thinking. So I think that for us to be quoting the Jeffersons of the world, and of course that's why he wanted universal education. He wanted universal education to save democracy. And in my mind, the people who most seek to undercut educational support are doing it for that very reason, because they know that it's true, because they know that you can't have control over masses of people when the masses of people are doing their own thinking.
Michael, to me, fuzzy thinking, just to get in on this, means people who don't think but think they're thinking.
Right. That's what's so dangerous about it.
You know, if you think you're thinking, then that's very fuzzy thinking. And what I mean by that is that people who think the thoughts of others rather than thinking their own thoughts. And I absolutely and vehemently agree with Raymond and with what Marianne has just said. It is the central issue in this country today. People who think the thoughts of others and then repeat those thoughts, sometimes rather loudly, as their own, and would sadly even kill others in support of those thoughts, which were not even their own thoughts, but thoughts given to them by some other source. So people who think that they're thinking and aren't thinking at all, but are simply repeating the thoughts of others, their political party, their religion, their particular dogma, the views of their parents, whatever it might be. We need to divorce ourselves. Here we go again with we're not who we were yesterday. We need to get into the present moment and think for ourselves for a change, and that's why the comments in Book 2 about what we need to do to change our educational system are so extraordinarily important. We have to teach young people that it's not about how we thought about things yesterday.
You know, Neil and Raymond, something interesting to me that was in this morning's paper is in this category and how the media affects this. There is an argument going on in Congress right now concerning a $16 billion that they had agreed to spend on insurance, medical insurance for non-insured children. And so the big argument, the big question that is posed by the Republicans and the Democrats, it's just mimicked by the media, the big question supposedly, in their minds anyway, is whether this will be spent as a federal programming or instead in lump sums given to the states, correct? State versus federal. But to me, the interesting thing is that the goal here is to ensure half of America's poor and uninsured children. The real question should be, why aren't we committing to insure all of them?
Bravo.
The real question should not be state versus federal. The real question should be, if you've got 20 million uninsured kids, why are we only talking 10 million? But people will just, you just see how powerful the that's how the parties present it, then that's how the media picks up, and you have to really have an alert mind to say, what the hell is the question? This is the wrong question we're asking.
Yes, you see, I'm reminded of Gloria, who was it now who said this, the wonderful statement on her deathbed. She said, what is the answer? And when no one could give her the answer, she said, in that case, what is the question?
Right. We're not asking. The reason we're not getting meaningful answers in America today is because we're not asking the meaningful
questions. Not asking
questions
the right questions.
Yet. And the power structure as it now exists, as your book makes very clear in Book 2, it is not. Its interests are not in line with asking the appropriate questions.
Precisely right, much less giving the answers.
Because the appropriate questions are not, as Conversations with God Part 2 makes very clear, the appropriate questions do not point to an economically based social structure. The appropriate questions are humanitarian questions rather than economic questions. And that's why the system as it now exists doesn't ask them.
The system is absolutely out of control and crazy. I'm beginning to feel like one of those guys who sit around the barbershop talking about the good old days. But I swear, really, I think society has reached a point now in 1997 that is just absolutely incomprehensible to anyone, as far as I can know. I mean, to get back to the medical issue for a moment, the problem with the kids, unfortunately, is just a tiny slice of the huge pie of chaos that's going on about the medical system. Not just poor kids, but even people who are fairly well off in the suburbs constantly have the sword of Damocles hanging over our heads of, will an illness just wipe out everything you have? That's absolutely insane. And the doctors hate it, and the patients hate it, but the technology just seems to be spinning out of control.